Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today, we have Richard Tedeschi on the podcast. Dr. Tedeschi is professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is a licensed psychologist specializing in bereavement and trauma and has led support groups for bereaved parents for over 20 years. With his colleague Lawrence Calhoun, he has published books on post-traumatic growth, an area of research that they have developed that examines personal transformations in the aftermath of traumatic life events. Their books include Trauma and Transformation, Post-Traumatic Growth, Facilitating Post-Traumatic Growth, Helping Bereaved Parents, A Clinician's Guide, and The Handbook of Post-Traumatic Growth. Richard, it's so great to chat with you today on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So I'm wondering, how in the world did you get involved in this topic? This was not, when you were at work, probably working on your dissertation, this was not a topic that was first and foremost in the trauma literature, right?
Well, I've been around for a long time, so
true.
I've been around before PTSD was even a diagnosis, so there you have it.
Right, right. Well, what was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on basically trust in psychotherapy. So it was a therapy analog study of how trust develops among between therapists and clients based on some of their personal characteristics and their similarities to one another. So that's what I was looking at then. So I was really interested coming out of graduate school in the concept of trust.
Gotcha. And like, where did things transition into this line of research that you currently work on? What's the origin story of it?
Yeah, I guess it came out of some questions I had in my own mind about my career and what I really wanted to do. By the time I got tenure at the university, I was really wondering how to combine more of my clinical interests with my research interests. And I was talking to my colleague Lawrence Calhoun about this and talking about what, you know, what I got started in psychology for in the first place. And now that I had tenure, I felt free. I could do whatever I pleased and not get fired. So I told him I was most interested in how people learn to live well and how people become wise about living. And so we started with the idea of wisdom, and we wanted to know more about that. And in the literature of the time, this is the mid-1980s, there wasn't a whole lot of good psychological study of wisdom. So we thought we'd tackle that. And we tackled it first by doing interviews with people we thought might have some wisdom and learned some things about living well in life. And so we talked to older people. These were especially bereaved older women, widows who had lost their husbands later in life. We talked to people who had suffered physical disabilities in adulthood, would become paralyzed, blinded and such because of illnesses, accidents and whatnot, but had done very well in their rehabilitation. And we thought maybe they knew something about how to live life well, given the struggles they've been through. So we started with interviews and we transcribed these interviews. We listened carefully what people were telling us, and some of the themes of what we later called post-traumatic growth started coming through in these interviews. So it all came about by listening carefully to people who knew more than us because they had lived through the things they were explaining to us.
That's wonderful. Well, how would you define post-traumatic growth, or how do you define it?
Post-traumatic growth is the positive changes that people often report, as a result of the struggle in the aftermath of traumatic events. So that definition, although it sounds very straightforward, has some important elements to it. A couple of things to point out is these are positive changes that are really transformative. They're not simple. They're not easy. And they represent major changes in people's lives. These changes occur in the aftermath of traumatic events. Mm. So they're not caused by the traumatic events themselves. The changes happen in the aftermath of these events as people struggle through this aftermath. So it's a struggle. It's not an easy process for people because life has handed them situations which have disrupted their understandings of their own lives, the world they live in, what kind of future they have, what we call core beliefs about themselves and their lives and their world. So this disruption leaves people very anxious and very much at sea in terms of how to go forward and what to do next and what sense to make out of things. It's a very confusing time. So it's a struggle to get through this and reconstruct a set of core beliefs that make more sense.
Yeah. And in your research, what are the main areas of growth you found that are replicable?
Well, what we did was when we did our interviews, we took certain phrases that showed up among the people we interviewed, and we used those to construct a quantitative inventory, a research measure, a survey, to try to measure this post-traumatic growth process. And when we subjected it to different kinds of analyses as we gave it to people, I'm not sure if your audience would probably know too much about some of the mathematical parts.
You'd be surprised.
It's a process called factor analysis, yeah. Good. We've got a very astute audience, perhaps. So we did this factor analysis, which takes all these items on this inventory and creates clusters out of them mathematically. And these clusters become essentially themes that are reflected in the measure. And it turned out that there's five themes or five domains of growth, five ways which people describe the post-traumatic growth that they encounter. And so the five areas or domains of post-traumatic growth are changed relationships with others, new possibilities for their lives, greater appreciation of living, a greater sense of personal strength, and spiritual or existential change. So those are the five areas of post-traumatic growth that we've uncovered, and they've been pretty consistently discovered across different cultures. So our measure has been translated into over two dozen different languages now. I'm losing track how many because I get requests all the time for translation. But at least two dozen different languages and across all kinds of cultures, this measure seems to show these domains of post-traumatic growth that I mentioned.
Yeah, I would even perhaps add a candidate addition to that. My colleague Marie Forgyard has shown that creative growth might be another one. So consider that. Okay. So you're saying you're not sure how that works?
Right, because we've done analyses of our measure of post-traumatic growth. So maybe she was using some different scale or items or something. So that may be. I was just talking about our measure and the ways we've seen it operate in several hundred different studies now. So,
gotcha.
So if she's talking about, you know, people being more creative as a result of going through some traumatic event, you know, that may show up in our measure in a different domain. It could show up, for example, in the domain of new possibilities. So that's where people find new priorities in their lives. They emphasize different things. They may do different kinds of work. So maybe they engage in some more creative endeavor as a result of some of the trauma that they've gone through. And maybe that's what she is finding.
Yeah. She wasn't using your scale, but she was just looking at the role of post-traumatic growth on self-perceptions of creative change. And she's found a significant effect, which actually makes me think of a question I wanted to ask you, which is, how do you distinguish properly between self-perceptions of change, you know, because these are self-report questionnaires you're using, versus actual change? They're not always the same thing. Is that right?
No, that's not right. When people report change on our inventory and we interview them, they're usually representing themselves very accurately. If you follow people across time, you generally find that these trajectories stay quite stable with the majority of people. Now, there is a small minority for whom the growth seems to decline over some period of time. Now, why that happens, you'd have to get into the stories of people's lives. And this is where it's a real challenge for researchers, because you really have to know people intimately in order to understand some of these things. So we could say, for example, in some of these people, that some things happened that have created some sort of a disruption, a further disruption in their lives, perhaps. We could say, if we follow them, that they're, for some of them, maybe their original ideas of growth didn't stand the test of time for them for one reason or another. But for the vast majority of people, we find that these experiences of growth are quite robust and represent real change. Now, when some people say it's not real or it's not actual, they say the only real growth is that which can be observed from the outside, that people can see, and it's behavioral change. And that's what some people have said about post-traumatic growth, that some of it may represent behavioral change. That's what they call actual growth. And then the rest of it is illusory and people are fooling themselves. But the thing about post-traumatic growth that's so important is perspective change means a lot to people. And that may be an internal experience that may not be so clear to the outside observer, but is very meaningful to the individual. So we don't just dismiss people's reports of growth just because they haven't embarked on a new career or started a foundation or something like that. There are more subtle changes that are very important. So, for example, I had a client one time, and I'm a clinician. You know, I do psychotherapy all the time, so I hear stories in depth, and that makes me think in some ways I'm different from a lot of researchers who don't do this kind of clinical work. Yeah. But for example, I remember a client I had who had two strokes. And after the second stroke, the doctors told him that he had an aneurysm that could kill him at any time. And what he had to do was remove all stress from his life. He had to stop physical activity. This is a guy about his 50s. Stop physical activity, quit his stressful job, and basically stay at home and just relax and be out of any kind of stress. So he did this, and he became depressed. As you might expect, that could happen. But, you know, when I started seeing him, we started talking about how he could live this life if he thought that this is how he had to live in order to survive. And what he started doing was taking a walk every day around his yard and practicing a mindful meditation around his yard. And he would notice things he never noticed before. He would look very carefully at things and experience everything in a very, very careful, slow-paced, deliberate fashion. And he said he started to feel much better. And he realized that he was missing out so much on life in his fast-paced old life. And he really appreciated this way of seeing the world that he hadn't seen before. So his whole perspective on how to view the world out there shifted into something that he said was much more profound than he ever experienced before. To the outside observer, it might look like he wasn't doing anything, but for him, it was profound. So who's to say what's actual growth and what's not? That's a judgment from the outside, but you have to get inside people's lives, understand things from their point of view in order to know the real story.
It seems analogous to me like life satisfaction questionnaires. I mean, those come, those are self-report, and no one would say that someone's self-reported life satisfaction questionnaire is not, you know, as valid as their actual, I don't even know what actual life satisfaction is compared to someone's subjective view of their life satisfaction, but it just seems somehow analogous.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment because I've often thought that when people say post-traumatic growth questionnaire, the inventory is just self-reports, I don't even trust it. Mm-hmm. Well, we trust all kinds of measures of things like depression, anxiety, PTSD, mm-hmm. self-report of all sorts of negative, horrible things. We don't question whether those are valid.
Yeah.
Psychology is built on self-report measures. Yeah. I mean, you know, 90% of our research is on self-report measures, and we sort of accept those. But some people have had trouble accepting these reports. They just don't believe that people can make these kinds of transformations for some reason or another. It's some kind of cynicism, perhaps. I'm not sure.
Well, what are some things that some of the critics do get right? I've been following the work of Aranda Jayakarikrim. I don't know if you've been reading his most recent papers on trying to tighten up the field scientifically.
Yeah, some familiar things he says. Yeah.
Are there some points he makes that are valid?
From what I'm interesting is that, well, I think, and maybe I misrepresent, I'm not sure, I haven't read everything he's written, but I remember that he said that unless there's personality change, that we should be looking at personality change as a indicator of growth. Personality, it depends on how you define personality. You know, I mean, I taught personality for 40 years at the university. So I'm well familiar with all the different kinds of approaches to personality that are out there. And there are some things about personality that seem to be pretty much baked in and don't change very much. So it's hard to get some essential things changing about personality. But around the edges of it, to some degree, when people are confronted with something that is what we call the core belief system or the assumptive world, like Ronnie Jalf Bowman talked about in the past, in the 90s, the assumptions that we make about our lives and how they're going to go. Or if we take a narrative approach, the idea that people are essentially internally writing their own autobiographies and looking into their futures, or the idea of the the possible selves and the future selves that we have in mind. All those are personality constructs. And we can use those constructs to understand pretty well some of these transformative experiences. I wouldn't say, for example, that we'd see a great deal of change in the big five personality factors or something like that. But we have found things like openness to experience or extroversion tend to be related to post-traumatic growth in a small way. You know, these aren't huge correlations, but there's a little bit of indication of that. And there's good reason why that may be the case. So, you know, if you're open to experience, open to novelty, and you have that kind of creative sense of yourself, you're more likely to be able to create a different kind of future for yourself. So post-traumatic growth is a creative process. If you're extroverted, if you look at the dimensions on extroversion in the big five, you find things like positive emotions, as well as a connection with other people. So people experience positive emotions may be more likely to see into a future that's essentially positive for them. And if you're willing to connect with other people, you're going to find some people who help guide you in some ways into a future that's better for yourself. And we've talked a lot in our work about these kinds of guides, these expert companions. So that's, you know, I mean, there's a role for understanding how personality fits with all this, but I wouldn't define post-traumatic growth very narrowly as personality change.
Fair enough. And that's the question of personality change is also a different question that you just raised, which was, are there certain individual differences that make it more likely for someone to go through post-traumatic growth? And that's a very interesting question too, scientifically. And the openness to experience one makes a lot of sense to me, because that's a topic, that's a personality trait I've studied with my career, and it is so strongly correlated with a search for meaning, which is so core to what to the kind of growth you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wanted to say something about current work that I'm doing. You know, in your introduction, you mentioned I'm a professor at University of North Carolina, Charlotte. I'm actually professor emeritus. I retired from UNC Charlotte. And I've been working for the past, during the my latter parts of my career there, and since my retirement, at Bouldercrest Institute, which is Bouldercrest Institute for Post-Traumatic Growth is founded for veterans and first responders who have trauma histories. And we have developed programs to help facilitate post-traumatic growth in these folks. And well over 1,000 people have come through our programs at this point. And we've just recently in the past year published a program evaluation of what we do. And we get really remarkable results in terms of post-traumatic growth in these populations. And we've designed a program that's based on our research in post-traumatic growth process, where we've come to understand how post-traumatic growth develops, and our program focuses on these important parts of the process. And in doing so, we've come up with a peer-based program to facilitate post-traumatic growth. So all the people who are the facilitators in these programs are veterans themselves or first responders. And we train them to deliver the program, and they've all been through the program themselves. So they have a lot of cultural competence. They can speak the language. They understand what these people have been through. And this peer-based model, I think, is something that has a lot of importance for how we deliver mental health services. If we can think about how to involve more peers in mental health service delivery, I think we can do a lot more to help people in this country who have trauma histories. So we've had a lot of success in applying our research on post-traumatic growth in this process. And I would encourage people to look up bouldercrest.org on the website, and you'll see we have two facilities, one in Virginia and one in Arizona, beautiful rural ranches, essentially, where we give first-rate accommodations to the people who come to the program, and it's all for free because it's funded by some generous donors, so no one has to pay for our programs. And we have people come for a week, but then we have them, we give them up to 18 months follow-through with contact with us in various ways, so that they can consolidate their learning that they've done during this week-long program. And it's not a clinical program, and it's not psychotherapy. It has a lot of recreational outdoor activities involved in it for a good reason, because all those activities demonstrate some things that they're going to have to be able to do in order to live well and experience post-traumatic growth. And then ultimately, as you just mentioned, the meaning that they derive from this experience comes when they plan out a life of service going forward. So they have a purpose where they benefit other people and do things for their greater community or their families or their country, whatever it might be, so that they reestablish a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. And that helps consolidate this post-traumatic growth process. So this is a way that we're applying all this research to helping people in some ways that are really remarkable. And we've got also now 8 different partners across the country, other veteran service organizations that we've trained up their staff to deliver these programs. So they're available not only in Virginia and Arizona, but Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Maine, Washington State, Arkansas, different places in the country, all delivering these programs. So I'm really proud to see how this concept of post-traumatic growth has been utilized for good for so many people. We're going to do more than that.
That is wonderful. Well, you know, I'm just trying to think of, you know, well, let me phrase this a different way. I think that it's important to emphasize with this kind of research that it's not the event itself which automatically leads to post-traumatic growth. It's that though there are a lot of various things that could go under the umbrella of trauma, and trauma in a certain degree is kind of in the eye of the beholder. But it's the meaning making that and the sort of cognitive restructuring that happens as a result of the situation. So am I fair to say that you have a pretty broad umbrella of what you include under the idea of trauma?
I think you've said it very well, that it's in the eye of the beholder. So we do not define trauma according to certain kinds of events, like you find in DSM and whatnot. Mm. Instead, trauma is a disruption of the core belief system, the assumptive world. That's what qualifies things as trauma to an individual. If they thought of themselves, their lives, and their world in a certain way, and then they experience this psychological earthquake, which disrupts that whole infrastructure, so they can't make sense of how to live anymore, that's traumatic, no matter what the event is that set it off. And you're right that it's not the event that creates the growth, it's what happens afterwards. Mm. What do they do with that disruption? How do they recreate a system of understanding how to live in a particular kind of world, which makes sense to them and allows them to go forward in a meaningful way? So we define trauma not according to events, but according to impact. And we see things from the point of view of the person that we're working with. I remember a long time ago, I was working with a fellow who had cancer, terminal cancer. Mm. And I made the mistake of saying to him, this must be the toughest thing you've had to deal with. And he said, no, actually not. My divorce was a lot tougher than this. And he explained to me why. He said, I always figured I was going to die. Everyone dies. and this is the way I'm going to die. So this is not surprising to me. Yeah, everybody's got to die. This just happens to be the way I'm going to go. I'm not surprised. However, my divorce was a shock. I never thought that I'd lose my wife and my kids and my family. That just disrupted my whole life and my sense of myself as a married man with a family. I never thought that would happen. So he talked about a disruption of his core belief system, essentially, with the divorce, but not with the cancer. So who's to say what's traumatic? You know, from the outsider, again, you know, outsiders making judgments about people is a problem. And we have to understand people's experience. So, yeah. You know, as a researcher, I know that sometimes doing kind of research, which just gets me, you know, scratching the surface and I don't know the story, but as a clinician, I get to know the story. And that's what's informed me a lot, just listening to stories and understanding this process.
I love that you bring those multiple perspectives to the table. It's not just about checklists and quantitative Likert scales, but you also care about the experience and listening to the experience of the person. In a lot of ways, that's a very humanistic psychology perspective of you. Are you?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because I think that's where I started. I mean, when I was in graduate school, my first clinical supervisor was a student of Carl Rogers, who some of your listeners might recognize as one of the early humanistic psychologists. All right, so I was taught by Carl Rogers' student, wow, and a guy who did some of the original psychotherapy process research with Rogers at Ohio State. That was William Snyder. His name was William Snyder. And I remember, I'll just go off on this tangent if you don't mind. I remember when he was teaching a psychotherapy, we had to record all our sessions. We had to listen through every session, transcribe every session. And everything that we did, we had to say something about how we came up with that comment and why we were responding to the client this way. He made us really think hard about how we were responding to people and really think of in ways to kind of justify anything that we would say, because he thought listening was important. If we're going to say something, it better be important, you know, because we got to pay attention to that person. So that's kind of where I came from originally.
Yeah. Well, I really love that perspective. I've been trying to resurrect humanistic psychology for what it's worth. You know, another point that seems to be very...
It's worth a lot.
Oh, great. Great. Sorry, there's a little bit of a delay. So if I talk over you, it's not intentional. Please know that. Another point that I think is really important to make here is that you're not making the case that growth requires suffering. There are certainly multiple paths to growth. And it also seems like you're not making the case that the person necessarily is grateful and would prefer the trauma over not having the trauma. It seems like you're not making that case either. Is that correct?
Well, let's take the first thing.
Yeah, there are two things.
There are various routes to growth, of course. So this isn't the only way people become wise or learn things or live better or discover meaning or I'm certainly not saying that. There are various routes to growth, and this is one way that this happens in human life. And I want to emphasize, just because Lawrence and I coined this term post-traumatic growth doesn't mean that it's a recent development. I mean, this goes back in human history. If you study the great religions, literature, I mean, it's all over the place. As long as there have been trauma, there's been growth, actually, growth and change. And we, you know, in our first book we wrote in 1995, we tried to cover a lot of that, point out how, you know, this is part of human experience. So that's one thing. And, then, you know, post-traumatic growth is certainly something that people value, but if they look at the event, which is the catalyst for it, you get different kinds of responses. Now, I like to quote Rabbi Harold Kushner, who wrote a book in the 1980s, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. His son Aaron died as a teenager. And there's a quote by him where he says, I have become, as a result of Aaron's life and death, a better pastor, a better rabbi, just a better person because of going through all of that. But I'd trade it for a second if I could have my son back and be just an average rabbi, right? But I cannot choose, right? So I worked for 25 years for a nonprofit that served bereaved parents, sat for 25 years in bereaved parent support groups. And no parent would say, oh, my child died was a good thing. It produced this growth in me. I mean, no parent would ever say that. But they would talk about change and growth, but they realized it's because what happened in the aftermath, right? Now, I also, in our first book, on the first page of our first book, quote one of our first research participants who was paralyzed. And he was a young man in his 20s, and he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him. He says he doesn't regret it. He says, I know that's hard to swallow, but it's the truth. And if you understand my story, you know why. He says, I was living a life that was really self-destructive and not meaningful. He was a musician, smoking a lot of pot in a rock and roll band, and got in a motor vehicle accident one night with his band and got paralyzed, ended up back home in rehab, and had to quit smoking pot. And in the rehab, one of his physicians asked him to talk to some of the other young men in the rehab who were also paralyzed and whatnot, because he seemed to have a pretty good attitude about it. And he found meaning in helping out these other young men. And he decided to go to college. He ended up getting a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling. And when I interviewed him, he was directing an agency for disabled people. He said, this never would have happened to me if I hadn't become paralyzed in that accident. I don't regret it at all. This life is much better than where I was headed. So it depends, you know. You got Harold Kushner and the rest of the bereaved parents. You've got this guy. And that wasn't the only story we've heard. You know, there was this. So anyway, it depends. You got to listen to individuals and understand their stories and their perspective. But I tend to believe people's perspective. You know, you listen to people and you sit with them and they're earnest. And they tell you stories like that. I believe what they're saying. So some people do say, hey, this terrible event, I don't regret it. Other people say, oh, I would undo it in a minute. It varies.
I hear you. And I appreciate that, that you acknowledge that some people's experience is that they are grateful for the event itself. So I appreciate that. Something that interests me very much is the role of culture and context in facilitating growth following adversity. So I am wondering, to what degree do culture shape the narration of people's stories about challenge, adversity, and failure?
Well, I'm not sure if this gets to your question, but I'll answer it this way, and then we'll go from there. Okay. As I've mentioned to you, there's you know, a lot of cultures where post-traumatic growth research has been done. And almost every day I get an email from someone somewhere in the world who is asking for permission to use the inventory or wants some advice or whatnot. Often, not always, but often they're students doing their dissertations and whatnot. And they may be in Pakistan, Indonesia, Nepal, who knows, just all kinds of places. You know, it's amazing to me. And they're picking up on this because they see these kinds of things in their own cultures, right? And they want to learn more about it. So it seems to be quite universal. Now, how it shows up, what domains of growth tend to happen, vary. So for example, I have a good friend, colleague, Kanataku, who is Japanese. And when she does research in Japan, she finds that one particular domain of post-traumatic growth does not show up much in Japan, and that's the one on personal strength. And she tells me that's because in Japan, you don't claim personal strength very much. It's a much more collectivistic culture, and you don't proclaim yourself above others. And so seeing yourself as kind of achieved more personal strength is a hard thing for a Japanese person to do. So then there you start to see a cultural difference compared to Americans, who are all about, you know, our rugged individualism and our egoism and all of that kind of stuff that's throughout our culture. So there are some variations like this across cultures and contexts. And so growth happens in maybe slightly different ways in different situations, you know, around the world. And of course, certain kinds of events might be more stronger catalysts for certain kinds of growth, perhaps, as well. So, for example, if you have a kind of event where people come to your assistance and your aid more, maybe in a natural disaster, for example, you might start to change your perception of your relationships with others, because you've been responded to in such positive and helpful ways, perhaps. So the kind of trauma, the kind of culture, you can create some variations on this, but generally the experience itself is very common across cultures.
Thank you. I was wondering about that. So another thing I was wondering about is the link between post-traumatic growth and PTSD. Can you have both at the same time, is what I'm trying to ask?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And so because the same kind of experiences that produce symptoms of PTSD are also the catalyst for post-traumatic growth. I mean, something bad, right? Something really bad. So you can get symptoms of PTSD along with post-traumatic growth. And post-traumatic growth does not wipe out symptoms of PTSD. They may co-occur, right? However, when we have done our studies at Boulder Crest with people who have typically quite a few PTSD symptoms, by the time they're through our program, those symptoms have alleviated to a great degree. They've dropped by more than half. And that's because our process of facilitating growth involves some things that at the same time address symptoms, especially a lot of emotion regulation strategies. And when people disclose to each other and support each other, that tends to alleviate a lot of the symptoms of PTSD as well. But what's really most interesting is that the enduring symptoms of PTSD carry less weight for people when they also experience growth, because they say to themselves, basically, okay, I still have some nightmares, but you know what? I'm living a life of service and meaning and purpose. So if I have to have some nightmares, I don't care as much about it. I guess it's a price I pay. And it just doesn't concern me as much. Because I'm doing something important with my life. So I'll put up with some of this stuff. So PTSD and post-traumatic growth co-occur. They're related, they're correlated about 0.2, 0.25 in a lot of studies. Because there has to be some kind of distress to create the fertile ground for post-traumatic growth. So you get distress as part of the picture.
Thanks. Yeah, I was wondering about that. How's your research on post-traumatic growth or growth after positive experiences informed how you think about PTG, if it's informed it at all?
Well, it's I can't say I know a lot about it. I may have read some of that work, but you know, I'm focused on how people change their narrative and their core belief system as a result of the experiences in the aftermath of difficult events. So, you know, when I think of this ecstatic thing, it's like positive events, wonderful positive events. So to the degree that that changes your perspective in terms of core belief system or your life narrative, I can imagine how that might be. There's something else I want to say about what post-traumatic growth experience is like for people. And that is, it's not an intellectual experience. It's an emotional experience. So people can, I've heard this many times. People say, I knew before these events in my life that I was supposed to live life in a certain way, or live life meaningfully would mean this or that or the other thing. But I know it differently now. I know it in a visceral way. I get it in a way that I can't go back to the old picture, the old perspective, because I've been essentially changed. And so if a positive experience can do that, well, fine. You know, there's that route to growth too. So there's an article that Charles Carver wrote back in 1998 about catastrophe theory in relation to this. And I think it's pretty interesting, because catastrophe theory is built on concepts that were applied to structures and materials. And materials can bend, and then they have a point that they break. And once they break, in this theory, they can't be reassembled in the same way. You know, it's like it's forever disrupted, right? That's the way we think about this change in the belief system. You know, the old system gets broken in some essential fashion that you just can't go back to seeing life in the same way you used to. This catastrophe has happened that breaks the old perspective, and now you're at a new plane, a new level. And that's why for people, post-traumatic growth tends to be sustained because of that sort of experience.
Do you see the pandemic as an opportunity to catalyze PTG at all?
Yes, for some people. You know, it depends. It depends is a phrase that psychologists like to use a lot.
Yeah, they do.
But because there's so many factors involved in the things, right? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it depends on whether the situations in people's lives create a challenge to the core belief system, the assumptive world, the assumptions people have made about how life is going to go. And for a lot of us, you know, we might have assumed that that in our world, in our first world, that we'd never suffer 700,000 deaths from some damn disease. We assumed that, you know, we'd be able to go to the hospital and get treated and instead of being turned away because it's all filled up. We always assumed that, you know, we can go out and hang out with people as we wanted to. I mean, there have been maybe a lot of assumptions we've made that that have been challenged by this. So if that has really rocked people's world so they can't go back to the way they used to function, maybe there's post-traumatic growth in that. Maybe they change the way they relate to other people. Maybe they shift their life in new directions. You know, a lot of people are quitting jobs and stuff like that. I read a little blurb in the New York Times, and I think it was just today, about the Great Resignation. People resigning from all kinds of things, just not doing what they used to do. And maybe that's a sign of some new possibilities for people, that they could create something different out of their lives. This has been a spiritual and existential change for people, where they realize how vulnerable we all are. And if that's the case, maybe you start living differently. These are all kinds of things here that could be happening. We'll have to see. But for some people, the pandemic hasn't changed things much. For other people, it's been devastating.
Mm. And for others, it's been transformative. Yeah.
Right. That's right.
You know, well, I want to end this interview today by just getting to the practical level. What are some tips or, you know, how is PTG best facilitated? What have you found in your research?
Well, if we look at what we've done at Boulder Crest, here's the facilitation process that we understand it. First, people have to be educated about why they've reacted the way they have psychologically and physiologically to the events that they've encountered. So it's important to understand that. It's important to understand the core belief process of disruption and to see the possibility of growth, to get a sense that that could be. In fact, when people apply to our program, that's one of the questions we ask them. Can you see possibly into the future anything better for yourself than what you've been through? Yeah. So there's that. Emotional regulation. People have to be able to regulate their emotions enough so that they can more deliberately think through reconstructing their core beliefs, figuring out what to believe, what makes sense to them, get past a lot of rumination that's very intrusive, and be more deliberate and reflective about their thinking process. So they got to have some good emotional regulation strategies. And then they have to be able to disclose or express themselves in some way to get what's inside outside in some fashion, so they can start to recreate some understanding of their lives, how they got to where they are, and where their life may be going. So they have a narrative that makes sense, and they can see a future for themselves. And that future should include some way to be of service in the world, some way to do something useful to benefit other people, not just live for themselves. Because out of that work of service, people are energized. I mean, those people, I mean, it's commonplace for people to say that when they give and they help, they feel like they get more out of it than the people that they help. So it's energizing, it's meaningful, gives a sense of purpose. People want to continue to do these things that feel so good. So that continues that growth process into people's lives, into their future. So that's what the process should look like for people. And that's the way we kind of organize our program.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for appearing on my podcast, but even more importantly, thank you for spearheading this whole field of investigation, which has taken off in lots of exciting directions by other researchers. I've been trying to look at this topic. I'm working on a book about this topic, actually, and you've inspired me a lot personally. And so I just must thank you so much for your time today and for all the great work you've done.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate your incisive questions, and it was a great time having a conversation with you.
Thank you. I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
You dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.